Blog Talk Radio.
Queen Mother Moore. Welcome, Queen Mother.
Thank you.
How did you become known as Queen Mother Moore?
Well, that name is historically and geographically first developed as a result of my years of activities in this country. When I went to Africa to Dr. Nkrumah Fiume, the chief heard about me, and he said for me to come to him. And I went, and he said, I'm going to make you officially Queen Mother, Queen Mother of the Ashanti. And he initiated me Queen Mother. But I was Queen Mother before I went to Africa.
Did you personally know the late Kwame Nkrumah?
Yes, I did. I knew him here.
Okay, you met him while he was here?
Yes.
Okay, and that is in conjunction with your work?
Yes.
I understand that you sent a petition to the United Nations in 1957 for reparations for the black people in America. Say something about that.
Well, the petition called for us to go back to Africa, for those who wanted to go back, and for those who wanted to stay here, they had to be certain indemnity given for the people who wanted to stay, the people who wanted to go.
What kind of indemnity?
Well, I was asking for $200
billion. $200
billion? Dollars.
To identify?
Yes, for the injury that we have received. The injury that the result of our enslavement.
Okay, that's for our 400 years of enslavement.
Yes.
As reparations, we requested $200 billion.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, when you sent this petition to the United Nations, what kind of response did you get?
I got a very good response. He told me that we needed a member nation to introduce the resolution, since we were not officially members of the UN.
Is this with your work with the Republic of New Africa?
No, that is not. I was with a member of the Ethiopian Women, the Universal Association of Ethiopian Women.
I understand that you founded that organization.
Yes.
And what was that organization about?
To save our men from execution. They were being executed at the rate of 2 a week almost. There was somebody being executed.
Was that unjustly executed?
Yes, we thought they were unjustly executed. And they tried to save some of them. They did save some.
That's
from the execution. The bat and poet. The same thing as the same Jenkins and the another brother.
Well, there was a number of people that were saved from execution because it was unjustly charged with crimes.
Yes.
And where did it take place?
In New Orleans.
Okay. And you also wrote to Marcus Garvey.
Yes.
Tell us first something about Marcus Garvey.
Well, I was first brought to Marcus Garvey really by the fact that I understood that he was to come and speak to us in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the meeting, and lo and behold, he didn't come. And we heard that the mayor refused to allow him to come. So we were very incensed about it and got a delegation to go see why. And then it was guaranteed that Marcus Garvey would come the next night. And the hall was packed with people. And everybody went with ammunition.
Had guns?
They had guns. Everybody had guns. Blue Steel, Smith Westerns, German Lugers. They had so many German Lugers because, you know, the war had boys from the war and everything. And I had two guns with me. And they all had guns and ammunition, a bag of ammunition. station. Everybody had a, what you call a suitcase to me.
You are in tune to New Day, Resurrection, and Liberation. Thank you for joining us for this special edition of New Day, Resurrection, and Liberation. Needless to say, we just heard some powerful words from none other than Queen Mother Audley Moore. Again, this is a special edition of New Day, and we are going to move forward with part three of our afternoon with Dr. Muhammad Ahmed, also known as Brother Max Stanford. And I thought it would be appropriate to talk about Queen Mother Moore, given the fact that Queen Mother Moore played a very important role in our brother's development, which we're going to hear more about today. We're going to talk about the development of RAM. We're going to talk about the Black Guard. We're going to talk about the African People's Party. I was fortunate enough to obtain the book written by our brother, Dr. Muhammad Ahmed, entitled We Will Return in the Whirlwind. And so you heard us end off with Queen Mother talking about the Honorable Marcus Garvey. And, of course, with that said, wasn't it Marcus Garvey, Honorable Marcus Garvey, that says, I will return in the whirlwind. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty much what it was said. Well, some say we're in the whirlwind now. And I kind of think some of that is true. It's time for some real powerful things to occur as they have before. And somehow things dissipated. People sold us out and got away with it, by the way. And, well, we're going to talk more about that later, too. But we're on the rise now. As they say sometimes in Philly and in other places, we're on the move. And with that said, we're moving forward and rising up for real African liberation. Again, we want to thank you all for tuning into this segment, and we're going to get right started because we want to cover a lot. We want to make sure that you're able to ask questions. I think a lot of our callers today probably won't be joining us. I totally forgot about Mr. Lashar Khan's speech is taking place right now as we speak. I had the opportunity to listen to it a little earlier, and he's still speaking. Some of it was very interesting, and particularly I saw where they brought up a very large photo, a very large picture of Baba Kwame Ture and recognizing him as, you know, him being some of the shoulders that many of us stand on today. And there were many other people that were, of course, there in the collage that was shown, including Dr. Khalid Abdul Muhammad, which tomorrow we will do a special edition in remembrance of Dr. Khalid Abdul Muhammad. We do so on February the 24th each year because while some kind of observe the February 17th or 18th as his day of transition, I do not. I do not because there is so much information that I have received over the years that brings questions to the actual day of his demise. We have some that is videoed with Brother Alton Maddox, where he says that when he got to the hospital, that the life support machine was not even plugged in. And we have other reports as well that indicate that Dr. Khalid was dead upon arrival. We're still going to do a further investigation, which we'll talk about tomorrow. We had a very successful one here in Philadelphia in 2004, I believe it was. Some information came out that had never been disclosed publicly before, and that inquiry was done right here in Philadelphia. It's so ironic that it was sisters, women, who forced the issue. And even some of the brothers said that it was a good thing because the men would not have done that because of all of the controversy and conflict that was around it. And therefore, it was best that the women did do that. But again, we didn't care one way or the other who thought whether we should or should not. We were going to do it anyway. And so under my direction, under my call, an inquest was held here in Philadelphia. I believe it was around January the 12th, which is Dr. Earth Day. And from that, we saw the first public report of a roughly a 27-page document that talked about his death, including the fact that he was allowed to lay on the floor for approximately 10 hours. So tomorrow we're going to go more into that and tell you about what some of the next steps are. But today we're going to again go into a final segment with Dr. Muhammad Ahmed, and we're going to talk about now moving forward. We're now into the 1964, I think we left off. We talked about Lamb being here in Philadelphia on Diamond Street. We talked, of course, about the influence of Queen Mother Moore, definitely the influence of El Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, Malcolm X. And we're going to go back to that, too, because, of course, February the 21st, we just observed another year of remembering Malcolm X. So all of this dialogue is just extremely, extremely important, powerful, significant, and we are certainly very thankful for it. So without any more said, we're going to get ready to go to our live line, and we are going to probably open up the chat room in about 5 minutes, but for now we're going to go to our live line, and we're going to begin our discussion and pick up from where we left off last week, and we're going to talk a little more about the book today, too, but joining us now, again, for our final segment of observing the, or shall we say, looking closer at the liberation movement, the civil rights movement of the 1950s, 1960s, but also kind of connecting the dots today so that we can see what's going on today. How can we move forward? How should we move forward? We're going to talk about with our brother, his relationship again with Malcolm X, with Queen Mother Moore, also with Brother Kwame Ture, Stephen Carmichael, and others. So this is so-called Black History Month. For us, of course, it's every day, but we have some things that's getting ready to happen, and it was very important for me because, you know, for the Men Women Movement now developing into what I envisioned it to be, we now have begun a major project called Recharge Genocide. So you heard earlier in playing something, some clips from Queen Mother Moore. Queen Mother Moore went to the UN in 1957, charging genocide, demanding reparations. Where is that at today with the various groups and organizations? Why are there so few? And so we're going to talk about that also. But for right now, we're going to go to our live line. And joining us now is Dr. Muhammad Ahmed, also known as Brother Max Sanford. My brother, do we have you?
Yes. Assalamu alaikum.
All right. Wa alaikum assalam, my brother. And thank you again for joining us.
Sure.
This segment today. And how did you, I'm sure you heard our opening with Queen Mother Moore.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
Powerful.
Very powerful. And Queen Mother in 1963. took a petition around and went to the White House, if I'm not mistaken. And she said that there was a 100-year stipulation to the 13th Amendment, I think, that if we did not contest our citizenship. No, it was the 14th. Mm-hmm. Because we never was asked whether we wanted to be citizens.
Right.
That it was a 100-year stipulation that if we did not contest our citizenship, mm-hmm. then we would automatically become citizens.
Mm.
So you got Attorney Robert Rock, who has passed, put in about November or December of 63, in the appellate division. He was in Los Angeles. And it is still in the appellate division. You know, last time I talked to him, yes, it has never been ruled upon. And, yeah, so, but she managed to get him to get it in, and that was led by the Self-Determination Committee. He was head of the Self-Determination Committee. Yeah. So, in 64, you know, I was traveling south. I went into Nashville, Tennessee, talked to, I guess, one of the deans there, and he gave us the facilities of Fisk University. This is before he found out, you know, who we were. And there was a group, a youth group that we, you know, had relations with, led by African-American sisters, by the way, called the Afro-American Student Movement. They were part of the, part of SNCC and part of the Nashville Student Movement, but they were nationalists, revolutionary nationalists, you know. And so they hosted, you know, our conference. Went into Atlanta and recruited people to come up to the conference. And Askia Muhammad Ture came in to Nashville, and we together helped structure the conference. And so we held the conference May 1st to 3rd, 1964. It was the first Afro-American, we was calling Afro-American, student conference on Black nationalism.
Wow.
The Mississippi, a lot of the guys from Mississippi came up. And so from the Mississippi field staff, Willie Peacock, who was key in the development of SNCC in Mississippi and throughout the South, he had brought me into Greenwood in 63. And so he said, let's go, you know, after the conference, Don Freeman from Cleveland, who was one of our featured speakers, and Askia go into the South. And so Willie had agreed that we would be part of the Mississippi SNCC project. And we went in and into Atlanta. John Lewis was chairman of SNCC then. And we sat with John Lewis. And John is a good guy, you know. And he said, well, I may not agree with what you guys believe, but you have the right. So we went into Mississippi and... Needless to say that it caused an uproar, you know. And what had happened in the meantime was Monthly Review had taken excerpts of Malcolm's speeches, excerpts of Robert F. Williams, wrote an editorial on the possibility of a minority revolution. Question mark, where he lays out that a minority can, you know, be the major force for a revolution. And so they combined that with the parts of the article that I had written for James and Grace Lee Boggs' correspondence article. he was called is the, I think it's the maybe June or August, you know, or July 1964 issue of Monthly Review. It was called The Colonial War at Home. It was editorial. So I come into the SNCC office, you know, and it's a brother that, you know, I knew, and, you know, I mean, he looked like he turned white, you know, like he had seen a ghost. And I said, hey, man, what's wrong? He said, have you seen the Monthly Review? This is in Jackson, Mississippi. I said, no. He said, he hands it to me. He says, here, sit down and read this, right? He said, the Klan said, when you're ready, come on. Right. And I'm in Jackson, Mississippi, right, when I get this order, right? So, well, anyway, Ski and I, we participated in the Freedom School, and then SNCC began to respond to the Klan burning churches. They were burning churches all down the state of Mississippi. You know, because that they were centers where people were meeting and where voter registration was coming from. And so the field staff decided and to resist. And they were going to go to the policy of self-defense, and they needed help. And so I called the brother and asked him to get me out of, you know, after all, situation happened. It's too long to go with that, you know, to go into that. But to get me out of Mississippi as soon as possible. I later found out that Robert Williams had sent a telegram. He had heard I was in Mississippi, and he had sent a telegram from Cuba, get out of Mississippi, but we were gone by that time. All right, so Askia was still there for a minute. And so the integration faction had, you know, tried to cut us off from food, and, you know, I mean, the sisters, you know, like, refused, right, at that point, you know, and said, well, you know, it ain't cutting the white folks off. So, I mean, I don't know what y'all, you know, we don't see you doing anything wrong. And so it was ideological. So we met with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, and they were going to go up to Atlantic City. And yeah, I told them, you know, we just keep trying. You know, I mean, what they were doing was important, but it may not, you know, win right away. I think that Bob Moses and others thought it was going to win right away, you know. So, and we had ideological discussion with Moses outside, you know, like behind a building. And at that point, Bob felt that he had friends and or SNCC had friends in the federal government. And we felt that the government, you know, was going to see us, see the movement as a threat, and that eventually repression was going to come. So that was our position, you know. So, I mean, because, you know, I mean, they had chased Robert up. And so we met at 3061 Field Street in Detroit, and put together RAM as a national organization, and people had come in, you know, and so we put together a 12-point program. People can go online. It's on the LexisNexis series in the RAM documents. And so in the process, we had elected Robert as international chairman, James Boggs as ideological chairman, Don Freeman as executive chairman, Grace Lee Boggs was secretary, Paul Brooks, who was out of the Nashville movement in 60 and 61, as a treasurer, along with Gaidi, or Milton Henry, attorney Milton Henry, as treasurer as well. You know, so we were in the kitchen of the Boggses, and I think it was William Worthy said, hey, well, we need an international spokesman. And Stan Malcolm would be a good international spokesman. And I said, well, I know Malcolm.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave us money, you know, they said, well, call him and, you know, write him. And I did, you know. And so three of us went by bus, you know, Willie Peacock, a brother named Steve Bass, and myself, into New York. And I called him, and he told me to come to Hotel Teresa, which I did. And I think we were staying with May Mallory, so it wasn't long, long distance, all up in Harlem. And he said, well, we can't, you know, talk in of the organization. You know. It was the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and he hadn't created the organization, the Afro-American Unit, yet. And so we went to 22 West Restaurant. And he had read the correspondence order, you know. He said, I like your order, you know. So, and so, you know, I asked him to become international spokesman. And at that point, I think Malcolm thought that they would put him in jail or put his followers in jail.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it wasn't until after he made the second trip to Africa where he had been poisoned that he realized, you know, the extent that he was to U.S. imperialism, you know, so. He said, well, it has to be secret because Robert is a fugitive. And he had helped Robert when he was here. So he's a fugitive, you know, from justice. And if I'm publicly identified with, you know, with Robert, then I could be indicted.
But was Brother Robert in Cuba at that time?
He was in Havana, Cuba at that time. So.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
And so... he kept me with him on a daily basis, and Queen Mother, who had taught him, helped him, she wanted him to say that we were African Americans, and that was her stickler with him. He felt that we weren't prepared to identify ourselves as African, right, at that point in time. So he was calling us Afro-American, which he had gotten, you know, Richard B. Moore had advanced that in the 40s, right, you know, so, and Richard B. Moore was one of the teachers in his liberation school. So, and then, John Henry Clark, of course, was one of his teachers. And he would take me past Michaud, Louis Michaud. Michaud's bookstore was one of his mentors. And they had a study group in the back, you know, him in the show, and he would show me what he was studying, and you know how, you know, I mean, you know, I guess Malcolm told me his whole life, and you know, I mean, he would drive me up Sugar Hill and show me nightclubs, you know, that he used to hang out with, and that how, you know, Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington, everybody, you know, I mean, he would meet because they would come through the community. He said, now they're downtown, see, you know, so.
Right.
And so I was in the initial planning. He was putting together the organization of Afro-American Unity.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know that he had already established a chapter in Ghana. All right, you know. And, you know, Malcolm operated on, you know, different levels, you know. And so, you know, with Mrs. Du Bois, I think, Alex Hunton, I think, and Maya Angelou, you know, and Julian Mayfield, you know. And so being around him, you know, Malcolm was, he was a brother, you know what I mean? Like, he could be comical. He'd keep you cracking up. Sometimes he'd be quiet, you know what I mean, in group meetings, right? You know, and people would be arguing. He knew how to synthesize or how to show people that they didn't have contradictions among one another. And I learned a lot, you know, from that. He took me and introduced me to Jesse Gray and his cadre that were doing housing, had done the housing rent strikes in Harlem. And, you know, so he was leaving the country, and some people say that Robert had called for me, and you know, somehow I ended up in Cuba. You know, so Malcolm went to Africa, and I went to Cuba. You know, and you know, in Cuba, we met other young brothers, you know, from around the country, and some of who I knew, and Robert recruited them in the RAM, and that's how, you know, it spread. So when I came back, you know, to the country, Malcolm was still in Africa, and people were saying, why was he staying so long? But he had been poisoned, and they said that he had he had been poisoned on the, he talked about this, you know, on the ship, right? I guess outside of in Egypt, you know, outside of Cairo, and they said he had enough poison in him to kill 10 men. But spiritually, you know, he survived it. And, so I would stay in contact with the secretary, Brother Abdullah, who can verify this, who was his, you know, secretary. And can you hear me? is something. And then Malcolm was assassinated. And we worked with Abdullah until Abdullah's Malcolm's men said that they were going to disappear. Hello? Can you hear me?
They're telling me they want you to speak, if you can, more into the phone because they're having a hard time hearing you.
Okay. Is this that better?
Yep, okay. I hope so. That's it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Then what we began to do is organize youth. Now, in the meantime, James Meredith was going to lead a march against fear in Mississippi, and he was shot in the back. And so Stokely had formed the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, and it had taken the image of a Black Panther as opposed to an elephant and a rooster in Alabama. And so the rooster had white supremacy over it, and that represented the Democratic Party, and then you had the elephant. Mm-hmm. So they chose the Black Panther Party, the Black Panther as a symbol.
Right.
And the press picked it up as the Black Panther Party. And they had an election in November of 66, and where 900 people in Lowndes County voted for the Black Panther Party or the Lowndes County Freedom Organization.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the meantime, what happens is that Dr. King and Stokely and representing SNCC and SCLC, and then I can't think of the brother's name right now who was representing CORE, they, you know, continue to march. And the deacons, right?
Is that the Deacons for Defense?
The Deacons for Defense. Came and provided security for them. What I had failed to mention was that in 65, when the Deacons first were organized out of Louisiana, Sister Dar Collins, Queen Mother, saying that this is before the formation of the Republic of New Africa. She was living in New Orleans, and she had talked to them, and she said they wouldn't listen to her because she was a woman. And so Queen Mother told me, so I sent a message through Queen Mother back to Sister Dar that we would make contact with them, and we went into Jonesboro. And the coordinator, he was named Chewy at the time. And he said, give me your number. You know, I mean, they had it secure. You know, I mean, he would come in from the outside. You know. So he came up to New York because he was raising funds. And you know, developed unity with the Deacons. Mm-hmm. So what should we say? Well, y'all take care of the politics. We'll take care of the defense. So James and Grace Lee Boggs, in the meantime, in 65, had form an organization. They called the conference to form an organization called the Organization for Black Power.
Oh.
And this is key because it's left out. See, it's left out. It didn't really get off the ground, but the concept did. See, and so the deacons came, you know, Chewing came, and so you had a north-south, you know, development, right? And by next year, Kwame was not the first one to call for Black Power, you know. So, I mean, the Boxers had raised the concept of Black Power in 65, and then Adam Clayton Powell Jr., Stokely's graduation, called for audacious Black Power. So when Meredith is shot, you know, and, you know, Stokely is, I don't know if he had become, I think he was chairman then, or becoming chairman. Yeah, he was chairman of SNCC. Willie Ricks, and excuse me if Willie is listening to this, I think his last name is Mikasa now.
Yes, Mikasa. Dada. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Willie, you know, if anybody knew Willie, you know, he could just stand on a street corner and have a rally. You know what I mean? That's the kind of charisma he had. You know what I mean? He would just stop and just start talking, and people would come around. You know, well, anyway, SNCC decided to test concept as a slogan. And they, and so Willie tested this, you know. And this is on ice. On the pride, and then told Kwame to raise it in a mass rally, and he did. And so that concept just, you know, I mean, like, it was yellow journalism, really. I mean, it was Black Power, you know, Black people talking about Black Power. And, you know, white people have been talking about White Power for how long, you know, so. And so you had the birth of the Black Power movement, you know. So, so when he had probably come back to Atlanta, Queen Mother Audley Moore, see, and again, this Queen Mother, she's a key person. You know, she's having Friday night forums on Black nationalism. At the YMCA at 135th and Lenox. Out of those discussions comes the concept forming a independent party in the North, in New York, in Harlem in particular.
Right.
We were based in Harlem, but all throughout New York, because there wasn't any kind of really mobility at that point to the Democratic Party. So we had, we were going to form this party, and I had gone to Queen Mother. She had formed the party called the African American Party for National Liberation in 63, which, you know, many of us in RAM were part of. And, you know, she had raised the national question of, you know, the Black Belt South is independent Black nation, you know. And, and so I went to her and said, can we use the party concept? She said, yes, go ahead. But change the name, you know. And she said, yeah. So I wrote Stokely and asked him, we create a Black Panther Party in the North that would support the Black Panther Party in the South or the Lowndes County mm-hmm. Freedom Organization. That's what it was mm-hmm. for, you know. And so he never wrote me back. Al Petola, who's putting together his memoirs, came, I saw him walking up one street, and he said, you know, they said, go ahead. What we did was create the New York Black Panther Party, and a lot of people in the party think it was the Harlem. It was not just the Harlem. It was the New York Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Stokely came up to New York, we met at a brother's apartment, and so we said, what can we do north and south that would be, you know, that would advance the struggle all over the country? And so it was agreed to build the Black Panther Party, and Stokely would be the coordinator. And so we put out calls to create coalitions with others and to form Black Panther parties, and Black Panther parties were established, I know, in Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, and I think Ron Wilkins had won the Black Panther political party in Los Angeles, Mamadou Lumumba, and the West Coast Ram formed the Black Panther Party in Northern California. Bobby Seale and Huey Newton formed the Black Panther Party for self-defense. They had differences in Northern California. We didn't know what they were doing. Now, probably Snake knew what they were doing. I see Stokely coming down 125th Street, right? And so he says, look, it's this guy, Huey P. Newton, this is the first time I ever heard Huey's name, is having problems with Mama doing this. Can they form a party? I said, well, the more the merrier. I had mm-hmm. no idea what was going on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Hoover, an article came out that I was leading with 1,000 blood brothers planning, you know, warfare in the country, you know. And so Hoover, nobody had talked to me. You know, and Robert told me to, you know, go to the State Department to see about coming to Cuba because he was having problems with the CP.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, of course, they kept my passport. And people were telling me, you need to get out of the country, you know. And so what happened was Hoover had a joint closed session of Congress, of the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
And he targets me. I didn't have a legal case against him. So I didn't even know anything about it because I hadn't seen it on TV. You know, so some guys who, you know, were around some legal people and other forces, they said, hey, man, I mean, you know, so they told me, they said, you have you have one of two alternatives. Nobody knows you. You know, I mean, like, I wasn't known in the, you know, in the press, you know. So, like, you have one or two alternatives. Get as close to Stokely as possible and speak every time he speaks, or disappear, you know, go under. And so I decided to go back to Philly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my hometown, you know, I mean, if it's going to come down, you know, I mean, I got better, you know, chances of fighting, you know,
from home
than up in New York. And in the meantime, a split had developed in the New York Black Panther Party. And after I had left, and because I just disappeared, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
As far as the public was concerned, but in my COINTELPRO documents, they knew who moved me time from 708 Eagle Avenue to Philadelphia. But they didn't tell the Philadelphia police, right? Which gave me enough time. So we reorganized here a central committee. And, you know, it was some brothers who had been kicked out of the nation, SNCC and others, you know. So we were originally going to create a Black Panther Party here, but then the leader, youth leader, who had saved the chairman of the party, the chairman who was elected was Lloyd Weaver. Lloyd Weaver was the great-grandson of Frederick Douglass. All right. And they had surrounded him with guns, and so Akama called me. So I told them, the youth, to go up there and surround Lloyd and take him out. They said, we don't have any guns. I said, look, put your hand in your pocket. Right. You got pieces.
Right. Right.
And they did, and they got him out of there. So when Akamal came down here, he was leader of the Black Guards, and it was originally inside the youth chapter inside the New York Black Panther Party. And he said, those guys have created so much, you know, dissension that, you know, I mean, the work that they had done in the period. And so we decided to try to unite all the gangs in Philadelphia into an organization, a youth organization, that would also be a defense organization and help the community. And it was called in Akama. You know, I said, what should it be called? And he said, the Black Guard. And so from there, that we voted on it in the Central Committee in Philadelphia, and it was to the Central Committee, National Central Committee, and it was decided that the Black Guard be raised around the country. And so while a lot of the repression occurred here, and people thought that the Black Guard was just here, the Black Guard was in other places too, you know. And so in Queens, New York, and of course we were infiltrated in New York, you know. And one of the agents, you know, came to Philadelphia and told them that had been the treasurer of the New York Black Panther Party. And he told me that, you know, that they had some kind of conspiracy in mind, but they wouldn't tell him. He was a member of BOSS, the Girls Secret Service. Mm-hmm. Right. And, well, anyway, one of the agents, I don't think he was a Rizmir agent, you know, but they probably scared him to death. And, you know, so this agent tells me that he's weak, you know, but he was the one that said that we were going to have these conversations and that I had to be in New York, you know. And so a conspiracy comes down. So, you know, the Queens DA, who was going to be indicted on embezzlement or some kind of, you know, white crime indictment, tells Hoover that he can, you know, create a conspiracy to destroy our organization. Mm. And this is so in, I guess, about May or June, I don't know which, it might have been June, this Queen 17 case breaks. They raid, you know, and they raid here in Florida and arrest me, you know. Mm-hmm. I fight extradition, you know. And I'm eventually extradited up to New York. And so in the meantime, the one of the brothers, you know, had gone into Howard, and had gone down to Howard, organized guards there. And the guards had run Percy, who was Selective Service Director off the stage, and in America's the Black Man's Battleground. And, you know, so, you know, it was a lot of stuff, you know, happening all across the country. And then, of course, Mike Simmons and then the Atlanta Project, you know, the year before had started anti-war demonstrations. By this time, Snake had a anti-war information center or something like that, where they were mm-hmm. telling people how to avoid the draft and, or, you know, mm-hmm. Reverend Clay, you know, having training ministers to resist, you know, and that's how the brother of the Wilmington 10 became a minister, you know, through Reverend Clay. And so I guess about 217 rebellions occurred, you know, during 67. They started, you know, long, hot summers. And that is because, you know, black men were unemployed, you know, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. and we were facing all kinds of conditions, you know. So, I mean, they were spontaneous, but the state always thinks that it's created by some external force, you know. So, and so, you know, I was arrested, got out, rearrested, you know, and then extradited to New York, you know, and I couldn't get bail. Hoover had it set up. He was going to wreck any bails, you know. So if I raised bail in New York, I'd be extradited back to Philly. If I raised bail in Philly, my they take my snatch my bail in New York, I'd be extradited back to New York. So, you know, no bail bonds would, you know, raise money for me. So I was, you know, in jail in New York, first in Kew Gardens, then later in the Tombs. Right? So you know, to make a long story short, what you have is in Orange in November of 1967, you had 4,000 or more African American students here in Philadelphia walk out of school. And this was led by the organization that John Churchville and Walt Palmer had. The guards were, you know, like part of, maybe not in that name. And that was started, I think, maybe in about 66. And that in there that with Father Paul Washington and, you know, well, it was a young guy named Dave Richardson, 19 years old, comes to them,
right,
and says, hey, we need to, you know, have this demonstration. And, you know, they helped him, and he, you know, organized 4,000 walkouts of school and marched on the Board of Education. Well, Frank Rizzo, who was dedicated to smashing black power and was a white power advocate, who was police commissioner at that time, told his police to attack the demonstration. And they did. And there's a picture of Rizzo with his knee on a 14-year-old sister. And I had interviewed her. I mean, she's not in Philadelphia anymore. I mean, she's not 14 anymore either, you know. But she was 14 at the time. Right. And so she was chanting, and Rizzo knocked her down and was clubbing her, right, and his knee on her, right? And so this incensed the African-American community. I mean, people who we couldn't even talk to before. I mean, they just beat these young brothers and sisters, you know. I'm getting this because I was in locked up. I'm in prison. And so when I get out, they tell me what had happened, you know. And so they said that the youth were just screaming, you know, running all through downtown, and, you know, guards, you know, some of the brothers, I mean, they went hand to hand with these police, you know. And, you know, so that, I think, kicked off the Philadelphia movement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Father Washington, you know, of course, was always the center. You know, I mean, he opened up his church to church advocate. And, you know, so that was the birth of the black student movement, I think, in Philadelphia. I mean, John, of course, and Walt can add more details. Well, in Orangeburg, South Carolina, you had fellows, I can't think of his first name right now, you know, but from SNCC, and a good man, and he's teaching down there now, you know. He had gone into Orangeburg and Inc. was developed in a history and cultural wing. And so with the students, and other students wanted to integrate a bowling alley. Well, it led into confrontation, and the police came up on the campus at night without warning. And I think they were around a bonfire or something, and the police opened fire on them. And I think killed at least four. It was called the Orangeburg Massacre. And so they put Sellers in. Sellers did a few years. I think he did 5 years in the penitentiary. They beat him and everything. And so, you know, this was like in about January of 1968. Well, Dr. King, April 4th, 1967, had announced his opposition to the war in Vietnam, and he was leading between that year, you know, demonstrations of 100,000 white activists, you know, students as well as adults. And you had Muhammad. You know, you can't leave out the people's camp, right? Muhammad Ali. He was drafted, and he refused to go in to the army. And so he would come to Howard, and, yeah, I mean, you're talking about, you know, thousands, right? You know, I was probably in prison at the time. But, you know, just word of mouth, they, you know, I mean, and, you know, I've seen pictures of him, you know, holding up message to the black man, speaking to, you know, I mean, he was a hero of, you know, so you had the birth of the anti-war movement, which started in black communities, right, you know, and just spread, you know, I mean, you know, white activists, when they left SNCC, when they were forced out of SNCC, they went on the college campuses, built SDS, and formed this, you know, anti-war movement, which was working in conjunction often with the black students, right? And so what happened was that during this period of time between 65 and 68, the society opened up as far as since the 40s. There was more jobs available for black folks than since World War II. All right. And so this, what happens April 4th, 1968, you know, Dr. King is murdered.
Right.
And when that happens, and so people just came out the woodworks, people marched, you know, so you had 5 percenters take over the march, Memorial March in of Dr. King in New York, and they demanded in Rap Brown, H. Rap Brown. Imam Jamil Alameen's release.
Yes.
And my release, you know. And word came from within, and was that I was going to be let out as a setup. All right. And so Jamil, they let Jamil out first. And then they came for me at night court. And through the, you know, prison gate, grapevine was, don't try anything. It's a setup. So, Sister Filet, what happened was these guys who had arrested me in 67, they come and they said, hey, Stanford, you know, you've been locked down all this time, so we're going to, the long way, I think, I don't know, either in the tombs or Kew Gardens, I don't know where I was at that time. We're going to go the long way around the Brooklyn to Ninth Court, right? So you can see New York. Right? So it was two of them, one sitting, one driving, the other sitting up front. They said, well, Stanford, since you've been locked up so long, we won't even put handcuffs on you. We'll put you in the back seat. And they said, well, Stanford, you used to live around in this area, didn't you? You know? Said, yeah. So they say, okay, we'll park here. We'll park a block away from the court. Right? And my partner will walk a half a block ahead of you, and I'll walk a half a block behind you so you can get some fresh air. Now, Sister Filet, this is at night. Mm-hmm. You know, in Brooklyn, right? And this is where I'm walking another last mile. So I'm looking at the rooftops of where it's going to come from, you know. So, you know what I mean? So I'm just walking, you know what I mean, you know, just pacing, you know. So we get down to the court, and this one of the guys says to his partner, well, hey, Stanford, they laughed. Stanford didn't try to go anywhere, you know. And if I had tried to go, I wouldn't be talking to you, you know. So then they bring me down to Philly and let me out. Well, we had been fairly poor, and people had loaned us a car, old little Volkswagen to get around in, the year before. Well, leaving the courthouse, I think it was Satterwhite, Malik, who they later killed, and he was driving, and another brother, and picked my wife up, and he said, we'll drive you home.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 1968 Eldorado in 1968.
Wow.
Color black and powder blue inside, and it was wrong. So they said, well, you have a minute, we'll go into your living room. I was living on Perky on the street at the time. And so, yeah, I said, okay. Yeah. And so they said, we got $1 million, and $1 million is on the way. I said, we who done it? They said, the Black Guard. I said, where'd we get $1 million? They said, some banks. So the brother was supposed to come by the next day. He didn't come by. So another brother came by, and he said, hey, you know, we haven't seen. And so I had then a young brother named Scotty came by,
and he had been part of the, I guess, third or fourth recruitment of the Black Guard. Right? Now, all the Black Guards did not sell out. And it was just the faction of it. You know, he was of the younger group. And so I told him, I said, I can train y'all politically, but I couldn't be out. Yeah, I used to be out, you know, in the park with them and all kinds of stuff. And you know, uh-huh. So I said, I can't do that, but I can train you politically. And the sisters, of course, hadn't sold them. Right?
Uh-huh.
So we went up to Newark and met with Amiri. And Amiri agreed that he would come anytime we'd have cultural affairs. And so we began to create an atmosphere,
uh-huh.
Or cultural atmosphere, political culture. We never saw it separate, you know, that, you know, gave some kind of breath that, you know, people could move or coalition. Mm-hmm. So
right.
We knew that the Claral people, or, you know, I forget the guy's name, who was having these Black Power conferences. Mm-hmm. So we blocked them. You know, I couldn't go anywhere because it would be conspiracy, you know. And so, and Walt Palmer, you know, can explain, and John Churchbrook can explain. We developed a broad host committee, and that the Black Power Conference was going to be at the Church of the Advent. In the meantime,
now, what year is this? What year is this?
This
the 1968?
1968.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we did, and the guards provided security. And to make a long story short, Cecil B. Moore had called me down to my office. To his office,
mm-hmm.
And he told me what I had to deal with. He told me that Stanley Branch was the Fed, and it later comes out in the when the people break into and got the documents that he was an FBI. I never trusted Stanley, you know, and so.
Mm.
And I'm not going to say, I'm not going to create a lot of controversy, but he explained what I had to deal with, who was who and what I had to deal with, all right? And so a brother got shot, you know, and, you know, so I asked him to go back. He was from Birmingham, Alabama. In order not to get killed. I mean, he was trained, so he rolled over and fired back, and, you know. So
uh-huh.
And so you started to have these kinds of things happening, right? And one of the brothers who had told me about this money coming, I had a couple of the young guys just roll up on him inside the Muntu Center and said that I wanted to see him, and he calls me and says, let's go out in Paramount Park. And he told me that the FBI had interviewed every last one who the guards, young guards,
uh-huh.
who had been arrested. It was 30 of them. You know, so, and told them, and it was just one who refused, and they
uh-huh.
later offed him, Rashid. They told them that they were going to let me out. and that anybody associated with me was gone for a long time. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I thanked him. Yeah, I really thanked him for it. I mean, I had been warned, pre-warned, but, I mean, that was a verification, all right? And the brother who was last getting out, who happened to be Anthony Montero's cousin, told me that they had, you know, had come to him as well, you know. So, and so I had been forewarned, you know. So what happens is that we have the Black Panther, we have the Black Power Conference, the third Black Power Conference. And at the Church of Abigail. So I'm standing on the outside, and there's a Black police captain, and he approaches me and says, "Max, can I talk to you?" I said, "Yeah, of course." You know, he said, "I'm a friend of your father's." He said, "I had to represent the Black police in the meeting, you know, with people here, and that, you know, what was decided, if anything happened to you, you're it." You know, it was coming for me. Right. So there was conflict with folks from the West Coast, and at one point we had to surround the church, and, you know, because the guards was from Philly, they, you know, I mean, and so, you know, people were kept alive because it would be blamed on us anyway. You know, I mean, we had a contingency plan if Rizzo attacked, how we would get everybody out of Philly, all the people, and, you know, spread it all across the country. So, and you know, with their intelligence, they probably knew we had a contingency plan. You know, and so, went off well, and so after the conference, a few of the faction that hadn't sold out, one of the brothers, Chop, Yamaya, who was our culture director, you know, in the net, and he survived. You know, he just slooped down as it was coming. Well, in the meantime, we had had a meeting. They had called a central committee meeting. All right. So one of the brothers of that faction who hadn't sold out, he asked to see me, you know, and so we met, you know, he's sitting on the sidewalk and, you know, on the steps, you know, and he said, "Hey, you better bring a piece." You know. I said, "What?" He said, "That's how deep it is," you know, and he told me what I had to give. Right? You know, so anyway, so I come in with two young brothers on, you know, I tell one brother, "Get near the door," right? And so it's 30 guys, you know. So I said, "What's this?" You know. They said, "Well, it's the extended central committee." The brothers wanted to see what you were going, you know, what's your position. I said, "It's $1 million for 1 million guys is a dollar a piece." What they will do is just trickle it down. We end up in factions and fight for it. I said, "You got them by the, and I won't say what I said, and, you know, they offered you $1 or $2 million, demand $20 million, they give you enough time to organize, and then when they come with the $20 million, you know, and they said, yeah, mm-hmm. That's what they thought you was going to say. We're going for the buck.
Mm.
Well, you know, I said, well, told them that they were just ease on out of here, you know, and so I had mm-hmm. my, you know, office had our back before. And they said, ah, what you going to do? I said, I'm going back to the street. He said, let us know. And I said, okay. You know, that had happened. Well, there was a shootout right on 52nd and Sampson, you know. And so I had to come back to into the Montreux Center to try to develop some stability. So we formed
mm-hmm.
an institute, you know, which James Boggs had come to, and he said that, you know, people, some whites were going to give him $1 million to form this National Black Institute, and he had a list
mm-hmm.
of names, right? And he said that they would give him the money, but they had to take my name off, Max Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy wouldn't do it. James would not do it. I said, man, take the money. No, he was principal. He wouldn't do it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, James and Grace left, and they used to go to, you know, their friends upstate, I mean, in Connecticut or somewhere. And so what we did was we took the name National Black Institute, and we developed the school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so all wasn't based around me. Playfell had classes. There was teachers there. There was, you know, a whole, you know, kind of, you know, beginning structure for black studies, you know, the National Black
mm-hmm.
Institute, you know.
Right.
And so what happened was, there was a minister I would, you know, used to hang out with, one of the revolutionary ministers. And so he was saying, what you need? I said, I need some money, man. So he said, what I'll do, I'm supposed to in Milwaukee at a reverend's, you know, gathering. And I'll tell him that you're coming out in place of me, and you'll get down on there. Well, I took the flight. I changed planes in Chicago and go out to Milwaukee. Well, I'm in this reverend's house right, before, you know, we were going to speak. In walks John Bracey, Jimmy out of Chicago, and a brother named Randy, Bruce Randell.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I know y'all don't have osmosis. How did you know I was here? They said, look, man, they let, I think it was the leader or one of the leaders of the Blackstone Rangers out who had 20 murder ones on him. And he held a press conference. Now, this was not all over the country. You know, I didn't know a thing about it. And he said that you had met with him in 67 and had given him some
mm-hmm.
dynamite to blow up the candidates of the National Democratic Convention that's being held in Chicago. I said, what? I don't know who this person was. You know, I had never met them, right? So they said, look, you changed planes in Chicago, didn't you? I said, yeah. You know, you're going back to Chicago? I said, yeah. So when you get to Chicago, that'll be it. All right, that'll be it. All right, so I rerouted flight to Detroit and, you know, told the brothers, meet me at the airport. This is probably the last time you're going to see me, you know. And, you know, the state was operating at a level that we couldn't control the media. We didn't control the legal apparatus, and they did all that. You know? They could
right.
create people in prison into agents and
mm-hmm.
plots
mm-hmm.
and all this, right? You know, so I came home and, you know, so I said, I'm going under, you know, and, you know, some people said, well, that's going to create a vacuum. I said, yeah, but, you know, I mean, you know, we did not have the power to stop it. And I got a speaking engagement in Howard. And I knew that would be my last speech. And I got a call that, you know, that the legal thing was coming down. Now, I was supposed to be in New York that day, but I had 90 days to go. So the brothers wanted to rest, so I let them rest. And when I came in the Philly, early in the morning, the police had been there, and one guy who has passed, who had been shot, wanted to get back at the guys who had shot him. And so
mm-hmm.
the police asked him who could give assassination orders. Now, I saved this nigga's life because they had surrounded him in the Montreux Center, and they were on 30 guys. Yeah, I said, you don't kill nobody in the office. You know, I mean, he was, I guess, on drugs or whatever. You know, he had a vendetta. So he named another brother and named myself. Right. And so the police had raided my ex house, you know, so we got him dead to right this time because they had it all on tape. He was alive. He was under police protection. And, you know, and they left. And so, you know, I had to pack my bags and hit the road, you know.
Wow.
And, it was just by the grace of the law that I was gone. You know, and
mm-hmm.
So we called a central committee meeting and we explained, you know, what level that the state was operating on and that we could not, people were being not only incarcerated, people were, you know, some people were murdered and
mm-hmm.
that we, you know, that may have not even been associated with us, you know. And so
right.
we could not, you know, bring this repression.
Mm-hmm.
Right. On our people that the state was beginning to develop a system within the movement. Everybody's becoming a political prisoner. So, you know, then this would cause great harm economically to
mm-hmm.
families, right? Getting
mm-hmm.
people out and, you know, stuff like that. Well, in the meantime, and real quick, when Huey has sent Bobby Seale and the delegation in May of 67, to march on the Sacramento state capitol, and they had empty weapons, but they had weapons
mm-hmm.
to protest the bill that they were, you know, at least challenging the police with guns, stating the law,
right,
mm-hmm. in Oakland, and they had been in their right to do that, you know.
Right, and this was the law regarding the right to carry arms.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when they marched, when I saw this on TV, I knew this was the beginning of the end. You know, that repression was going to come on the entire movement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I called the Mamadou, cursing him out. You know, he says, not me, man, you know. And so, you know, all the Panther chapters that we had organized, I told them to go under. I mean, just join other organizations, work in the community, but, you know, don't use,
mm-hmm.
you know, right. And so that it happened, right. And so by 68, the repression was coming. And so mm-hmm. when I was arrested, I think in July of 67, Lieutenant Fensel, right. He brings me into his office. He said, I had many hats, and, you know, he had been in the Army in intelligence in World War II, came, you know,
mm-hmm.
established, you know, the intelligence division. So he says, look, if it was left to me, I'd let you go. I'd give you enough rope to hang yourself. He said, I know we're going to have trouble out of you later because we don't have enough on you. You know, we don't have to eventually let you go.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but it's coming from higher up. He said, but we got you. He said, you know, we have intelligence just like you have intelligence. Right? He said, but we got you. Now is your boy, Huey P. Newton.
Mm.
Right? On the West Coast, that was the second time I had heard Huey's name. Right? The third time I heard Huey's name, coming back from either a bail hearing on Ninth Court into Holmesburg. They had put us in Holmesburg prison. I'm walking in the cell block. Huey P. Newton, Minister of Self-Defense of the Black Panther Party, had been shot. That was in October. Right. And so that was 67. That was the third time I heard Huey's name.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for 4 years, you know, I was under. You know, and so, you know, like I said, I have amnesia, so I don't know where, what, anything happened. Yeah, I don't know where I was, you know, like periodic amnesia, you know, for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was captured in, I think, September of 1972 in San Diego. And so, to make a long story short, that, you know, they jumped me, you know, and beat me unconscious. And we fought, you know, but they outnumbered me. And so,
mm-hmm.
when I'm, you know, being brought up into population. I'm coming back from my lawyer, and it's this one of these guys, you know, right? He had a mouse on his eye, and he said, Stanford, you're a good fighter. But we control this prison. He said, we formed a Nazi unit in Vietnam to fight the communists.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, he said, you're a captive, you know, was, you know, captured, you know, I mean, prisoner of war as far as he was concerned. He said, we can, the Nazis, we control this American Nazi inside the, of the jail. Right? You know, so we control this. You know, so. Anyway, I was let out, and Nathan Hare went up to San Francisco, and they formed a defense committee for me, MADC, Muhammad Ahmed Defense Committee. And I was reincarcerated, and students out of Southern University were beaten. And so people asked me to, you know, come to their defense. And so I was reincarcerated and then extradited to New York. And eventually let out, you know, in the spring, and then extradited back to Philadelphia. Cecil had promised my father that if I returned, that he would, you know, work to get all my cases dropped. And they were dropped, you know. And, you know, those legal guys, they really, those brothers around the NAACP and had really done some work. And we had to fight New York. And so a prison worker had some, well, to make a long story short, they were trying to kill me, you know, on the outside. And I had been Ferguson, Merrill Stewart, and Robert Williams had put out I had been a CIA, you know what I mean, you know. And so I didn't
find this, was out. That Baba Herman Ferguson?
Yeah. I mean,
okay.
You know, so, I mean, like, you know, guys would be hollering, you know, you know, there's all people wanting and stuff. Yeah, you know, I didn't know what he was talking about. And I did because Queen Mother had told me what Robert had said, but it was hard for me to get all that together, you know. And so when I get out, Merrill, you know, he meets me at the, you know, house, the court, and he say, my wife said there's no way possibly you could be an agent. I said, Merrill, what are you talking about, you know? And he said it was us that put it out. I mean, that was, you know, I don't know, that was like a shock behind a shock, you know what I mean? And Merrill, you know what I mean, he was a very good friend, you know. And he said, don't worry, we'll put it out, and it will be like a pebble in, you know, in a pond. But a lot of guys in New York put, there's two young brothers. One brother gave me 9 months or a year. Both of them gave me a year. And they would put these brothers through actually hell. I mean, you know, they would, you know, in meetings and stuff, do you realize that you're defending? And, you know, so what happened was, a white prison worker, she was jumped with some of my material, and while she was working, my defense material, and we told her to publicize, and she was beat. I went to I can't think of his name now. You know, a lawyer who used to defend all of this. He established the institutional Center for Constitutional Rights.
Oh, not Ron Daniels.
No, he's white. He's a white Jewish. He's his name will come to me. What happened was I took a document that had me in, was published by Congress in 1969. And it was used by Hoover in this closed session, you know, to say I was a threat. And Kunstler, William Kunstler.
William Kunstler, yes. Mm-hmm.
William Kunstler, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I gave him the document, and I said, look, you know, I mean, I think Section 1983 of the 1964 Civil Rights Act said if one or more public officials conspired against you, then you had a right to take them to court, to sue, or in prison. They probably have taken that section out. So I gave it to Kunstler to study, and so he was part of my constitutional team. O.T. Wells, you know, I think argued it. And so Kunstler called me. He said, oh, come down and see me. Okay. And we took a walk. And he said, now, you know, it's their system. I said, yeah. He said, you got them dead to right. It's their, yeah, I mean, they got it black and white. You know, it is, it's for you. It didn't have anything legal, or when it was, you know, originally done. He said, but they can't let you in because your case would be like a Miranda case, and it would set conditions. All political prisoners would be released.
Wow.
So they're going to give you an offer that you can't refuse. Take it. And so we took Rizzo, Tate, Rockefeller, and I think it was Scranton, but, you know, all the key officials in the state. So, Pennsylvania and New York. And police commissioners, you know, in this suit, right, and in the federal court. And they threw it out on a technicality.
Wow.
So then the New York DA calls my lawyer, O.T. Wells, and asks for a conference. Well, it was interesting. The head of my defense committee, it was my lawyer, and a couple other people. Now I'm sitting on the other side, you know, where the DA sits. The DA wouldn't look at me. Right? The DA turns frustrated, turns to the lawyer and says, what Stanford want? So I said, I wanted a Class A misdemeanor. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so in that conference, it wasn't anything black and white. It was supposed to be a Class A misdemeanor, but they gave me a Class D felony. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And they consolidated everything. And they said, you did jump bail. I said, yeah, I did jump bail. So they consolidated everything into a jumping bail. And so,
mm-hmm.
right, time served and 3 years probation. Right. So I got out, and then I went to Cleveland to look for a job and was traveling around looking for a job. And so what happens is a young guy, they call and ask where I am. The young guy says, well, he's on the coast. Yeah. And so you know, I had been on the coast, and was supposed to speak in L.A. The guys called me, get $4,000 if you come, you know. And then a skier calls and says, hey, you get Fourth Aim Day in New York to debate Kwame. Now, I say, well, two and two always doesn't make four. All right. Hey, you don't get a speaking engagement for $4,000 in L.A., right, and $4,000 in New York on the same day. Right, you know. And so I'm in, guys that got me out to San Francisco, you know, they on a one-way ticket, right, and then they were going to be negotiating, you know, with the administrator, and they said, well, the negotiation broke down, there's no money. We don't have no money for it to get back. So I told the guys in L.A., I'll be there. Told us, I'll be there. And I told them, I said, get me some money to, you know, get back to Cleveland. So he said, we don't have no money. I said, if you don't get me some money to get back to Cleveland, I'm going to go to Cannes and go bar to bar in San Francisco, to, you know, and tell them that you got me trapped out here. Right. Needless to say,
we're going to have to hold that point. I'm okay. Just getting the notice that we have run out of time. I can't believe it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We only have a few more minutes, but no. I mean, we needed to really hear. But family, those of you who are streaming, you're going to lose us in about 1 minute. We have run out of time for our streaming. We're going to have to go with part four, I guess, because we really need to hear more. We're going to have our brother to finish this particular story. For those of you who are using your podcast, you'll be able to hear it. Unfortunately, those who are streaming, you're going to lose it in about 30 seconds or so, but we are going to bring them back. We don't know when, but we certainly will. But my brother finished this last point, and then we're going to have to close out, and I'll have to call you, and we have to do another segment.
So anyway, they get a ticket in another name. I run, catch the flight, get to Cleveland. As I'm coming in to the apartment, my lady's watching it on TV. The freeze is being killed in L.A. He was, you know, had kidnapped Patty Purse and all that. The guys called me from L.A. that we don't know why you didn't come, but you did the right thing because you would have been killed in the crossfire. I was supposed to speak 90 yards
month,
away
what
from
month,
where it happened.
Do you recall what month that was?
It might have been August. It might have been July of 1974, I think. I had been offered a scholarship to return to school. And I called that day and said, is the scholarship there? Right. And they said, if you want to come. And I went, you know, drove through Philly up to New York and up to Amherst. And the whole faculty wrote the probation, because I had violated probation, saying that, you know, it would be a shame, right, you know, if they reincarcerated me. So they assigned me to Boston. So I couldn't leave Massachusetts for 3 years without reporting. So I went back to school.
So now, so at this COINTELPRO is really at a high level.
Yes.
Would it be safe to say that?
Yes. I got four volumes in 1977. And they trace those four volumes go from 1962 or maybe 63 to 77. Trace me all the way, you know, So COINTELPRO is still going on, it's just a different name. Or no name. Right.
Wow. My brother, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but it's a couple of questions that I definitely have to ask before we wind this segment up. And that is, of course, as I began to read the book, I had started reading it, I mean, it's so much information in it. And I also want to mention, of course, that on the back cover, Mumia Abu-Jamal, of course, you know, writes some notes. But I want to ask a couple of questions before we close out. And one in particular is because this is something that's been really on my mind being in Philadelphia and having watched what, you know, how some of these people operate here. It is obvious to me that as you were growing and developing, and certainly once it was known and seen that you were active, that you were committed, that the payoffs began to emerge. Would it be kind of safe to say that that is, in fact, what happened or some of what also happened in the demise or in lessening the impact, well, not the impact, but in just beginning to
They will offer
break
you
into
everything.
Peace.
They will offer
right.
you everything.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
They'll offer you money. You know, I've had the offer of $1 million. All
right. Right.
You know, and, you know, refused. They will offer you, if you're a man, they'll offer you women. If you're a woman, they'll offer you men. Right. They'll offer you glory. Right. Anything. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, if people have done anything and they know about it, they will compromise them, right, and give them what they want, you know. And people that attempt to follow principle, if they cannot kill you, they will marginalize you in the community.
Mm-hmm.
because they have seduced so many. And with your cultural infrastructure, which Hal Cruz talked about, they are constantly bombarding us with misinformation. You know, so, I mean, like, Malcolm became an icon after his death.
Right.
When he was alive, most people wouldn't, you know, be around Malcolm. They were scared enough to be around Malcolm. That's how they were, you know, marginalized him. Right. And, you know, so when Martin took a principled stand against the U.S. aggression against the people of Vietnam, hey, they marginalized Martin. And even in his own organization, they said, you're crazy to go up against the strongest man in the world, which is President of the United States.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, it's happened before. Marcus Noble drew out. You know.
Sure.
You know, yeah. You know, so, you know.
Wow. So, needless to say, this is why today we have so few people who are willing to stand up or, better yet, to put themselves out there, knowing that if they do, what the outcome will more than likely be.
Yeah.
Wow.
But,
it kind of it makes sense, unfortunately, but at the same time, you know, it's it is what it is, and it's got to be what it got to be.
Well, it's a protracted struggle, and we have to use the contradictions of the system against itself. And as Ella Baker used to say, so we don't stop struggling, but we learn the serenity prayer. Allah, please give me the sense to know what I can do and what I can't do. Right? And always tell everybody, leave the driving to Allah or the universal dialect.
Wow. With that said, my brother, I want to thank you again for sharing these past few hours. And it seems like so much less than 2 hours, but it just goes to show you there's so much to grasp and to, you know, really begin to understand to a better extent. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to put any time limits on that. So I want that understood. I know we said three sessions, but obviously at some point in the very near future, we will continue because it's too much to try to, you know, limit to a time period. I don't want to do that. So we will continue this dialogue. We will continue to share more. There are folks still trying to tune in. I'm looking at my board, and we can't let anyone else
well,
in.
Well,
you know,
next time with those questions, you know, that people have or let people call in, then, you know, go from there. You know, I'm sorry, I'm an old man.
No, because, see, it'll be hard for people to ask questions if they don't hear the information, you see. So that's why it's so important that we are patient and are able to listen, because that, to me, is how questions can be better formulated, and with that, answers can be more, you know, succinct and productive. So, no, not at all. I know for me now, when I have some future questions, I can ask them with more insight. Because, see, I'm listening and I'm putting timetables together, you see,
to help, you know, do an evaluation. So the questions now will have more meaning, at least for me, you know, in terms of now I can really see a bigger picture and can understand it a little better. So, no, do not ever apologize because, as we often know, in some dialogues, you have to go with the flow.
Okay. All right.
And so that, go ahead.
We can pick up with the formation of the African People's Party. You may want to interview Saladin Muhammad because he, I think, became one of the, if not the principal leader of the African People's Party. And it was eventually centered in Philadelphia. And so, you know, there are people around who may want to kick in on that.
Well, wonderful. If you will get their contact information, I will contact them.
Sure. Okay.
And see if we can get them on and really, you know, give more information and more insight.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes. Well, I want to say shukran. Thank you.
And thank you. And family, we thank all of you as well for continuing to tune in and sharing this information with us. And always know that you can go to the archives if there's something that you want to review. You can go to the archives at www.blogtalkradio.com/EmpressChi. And all you do is just go to the date, and you're able to access any of our radio broadcasts for the past 6 years. And as a matter of fact, we will be celebrating that six-year anniversary in a couple of months, in April. We'll be here for 6 years. So we'll be telling you more about that very soon as well. In the meantime, we thank you all again for tuning into this segment. We've been talking with Dr. Muhammad Atnab, Brother Max Stanford, and we've been kind of really doing a crash course in looking at 1950, 1960s civil rights movement, as well as, of course, the Black Liberation part of that movement or the development of the Black Liberation struggle. And we want to go more into that particular aspect of being some of the dots we've talked about. We start off, of course, with Queen Mother Moore. We want to talk more about Mother Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer and others as we go into March, Women's History Month. But, of course, we're going to look at it all. So, again, we want to thank all of you for, again, tuning in and telling other folks about our program here. And we're going to continue to bring it to you. So, again, Brother Muhammad, thank you so very much again. Oh, when we come back the next time, we want to do also kind of go into what's going on at Temple, okay, because people have been asking about that. Last night we had Sister Pam on, and she gave a wonderful report, a history, a kind of history of when she got involved in the dialogue with Malefia Santi and the fact that Mumia, you know, were trying to get a doctorate degree for Mumia and so forth. She ran all of it last night. So, you know, again, we want to connect some of the dots. So the next time we talk, we want to also, you know, take a look at that, too, so that we can see how we're going to further develop some strategies as it pertains to that as well.
Okay.
So, again, we thank all of you, and we will be back next week. And for those of you who are not getting our e-blast, just send us an email at nationalmwaol.com. Again, nationalmwm@aol.com. Hopefully very soon also we'll be able to tell you about some of the special projects that we're working on, including the Mumia Abu-Jamal School of Journalism, where we hope to be getting some communication courses from Mumia to help us with our writing and investigative reporting and so forth. We'll be able to tell you more about that very soon, too. Again, my brother, thank you so much, and
we're going to do the wrap right about now. Let's see, before we do, we had something we wanted to share with everyone as we leave out. And I think this one is, wow, we were trying to pull this clip for you, and it's not coming up. We've been having a few technical difficulties, so hopefully you all kind of know what's going on. Last night, we, from what I'm told, we got blanked out for almost a whole half an hour. People lost our signal during the last half an hour of our program, but usually we're able to get things straightened out. So just continue to hang in there, family, because you know what technology does, and we, you know, do the best that we can with what we have. But at any rate, we're going to be back again, as we said, next week, Saturday. Oh, special edition tomorrow, Dr. Khaled Abdul-Muhammad. And also, we have another special edition on Thursday. We're going to talk about, do you really know what you think you know about the national anthem? I think you're going to be a little surprised when you hear some of the information on that. So Thursday, we'll be doing another special edition. We're going to be talking about the Black National Anthem and give you some information that you may not be aware of. We want to play a clip for you with Fannie Lou Hamer. Unfortunately, we're not able to pull it up, having some technical difficulties, so we'll be bringing that to you the next time. At any rate, we thank you all again. And again, we will leave you as we oftentimes greet you, and that is in the spirit of Ma'at and Hotep. But remember, there can be no real peace, no real Hotep, until there's truly justice, meaning Ma'at. Until next time, we leave you with the spirit and the intention for power, prosperity, and peace. Promote it to the Shemdar. Together we shall win.
Peace.